from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Germany in 1938, one day after Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. A young boy and his brother watched through a banister as two Gestapo agents stood at their door. The agents were there to arrest their father. When they learned he wasn't home, the Gestapo agents left and later found him at the textile mill where he did work. And the boy's father and grandfather were both sent to Dachau concentration camp. Now, the little boy on the stairs was Warren Heilbronner. Decades later, he says he still vividly remembers that morning. Warren and his family, including his father, were able to emigrate to the United States. They arrived in March 1939 when Warren was 7 years old. 80 years after Kristallnacht, Warren and several other Holocaust survivors are sharing their stories with the Rochester community. It all takes place next Thursday night, 1 week from tonight, at Temple Brith Kodesh. The speakers will also explore the questions, what have we learned since Kristallnacht, and what lessons from history can we apply to today, perhaps in light of recent violence across our nation. Our guests this hour discuss those questions, and they share their remarkable stories of survival. Joining me in studio, we welcome back Warren Heilbronner, a Holocaust survivor. Warren, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here for this sad occasion.
You got it. Well, there's a lot to discuss. Warner Schenck is here. Warner is a Holocaust survivor as well. Warner, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure and duty to be here and talk about it.
And Bonnie Abrams is director of the Center for Holocaust Awareness and Information at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. Bonnie, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having us.
1 week from tonight, the event is called 80 Years After Kristallnacht, Remember and Be the Light. Tell us about what you'd like to do 1 week from tonight, Bonnie.
We want people to remember those events, but not just to remember history, but to take it forward to today, because we really want baseless hatred to be eradicated. One of the things we're going to be doing that evening, besides hearing from both Warren and Werner and several generations of Holocaust survivors, is we're also going to have refugee agencies after the program, representatives there to give out material to tell people how they can help today's refugees. Then the next night, which actually is Kristallnacht, this may seem like it doesn't mean much, but we're asking people to light a candle in their window. And people say, well, what good can a candle do? Well, besides protesting baseless hatred, if you think back to 1993 in Billings, Montana, when during Hanukkah, a stone was hurled through the window of a little boy who had a menorah displayed, and much of the town put pictures of menorahs in their windows. And even though neo-Nazis and white supremacists kept destroying the non-Jewish property, they kept displaying the menorahs, and eventually the neo-Nazis went away. So maybe I'm being a little idealistic, but that's my hope.
Your hope is for our entire community to light a candle in the window.
On the 9th.
So that is next Friday. That's a week from tomorrow night, which does mark 80 years since Kristallnacht.
Yes.
Okay. The event Remember and Be the Light is next Thursday night, as Bonnie mentioned. That is starting at 7 p.m. So it's from 7 to 8 p.m. at Temple Brith Kodesh. It's free of charge. And an important note on, I'm looking at this poster here, says all are welcome.
That's right.
Jewish and non-Jewish,
the
entire community.
Just as we saw the support of the entire community there on Sunday night after the tragedy in Pittsburgh, we invite again the whole community to join us.
What I don't want to do is, Bonnie, is overstate parallels, but I also don't want to miss warning signs of hatred. And I know there's a lot of comparisons made. I just want to ask you what it was like to see, several thousand people in the Rochester community just last weekend after the events in Pittsburgh.
It was, you know, it's hard to say. With the pain of the event, really a lot of comfort came to many of us in the Jewish community by seeing people of all faiths there to support us. This community has wonderful interfaith relations, and I'm so grateful for that. And I think it meant a lot to the Jewish community in general to see all that outpour of support.
Werner and Warren, can I ask both of you briefly for your thoughts on what we saw in Pittsburgh last weekend? And Werner, I'll start with you. What do you make of that?
Yes. When I first heard about it, I expected a knock on the door and the Gestapo coming for me. I had shivers up and down my spine. I couldn't believe that this was happening. And it continued. You know, I'm a graduate and also worked at the University of Rochester, and a swastika was smeared on the elevator at the Eastman School of Music, same day or the next day. So it's the same reaction I had when Kristallnacht happened, and I'm sure we'll talk about my impression then. I kept asking my parents, why is this happening? And that's my question now. Why is this still going on? I don't have an answer. I don't think I ever will.
Warren?
Well, for me, it was sort of a benchmark because, as was reported, this was the largest killing of Jews in the United States. And it just harkens back to the killings that were going on in Germany. And the saddest part is that although there was a hue and cry outside in the press everywhere about the event, the sad part is that for many, many people, it probably said, oh, another shooting in this country. When will it end? That's the real question. When will this hatred that's going on, even with politicians, when is it going to end? And you just wonder, when's the next shoe going to drop and where?
It is correct to point out that according to the Anti-Defamation League, this is the most deadly attack on the Jewish community in this country, in our history. Warren and Werner, do you feel generally unsafe at all? I don't mean to sort of ask an obvious or flip question, but I do think it bears asking if you have felt less safe in recent years, today than perhaps 5, 10, even 25 years ago, or if you view what happened in Pittsburgh as certainly a remnant of hatred, but not necessarily a mainstream sort of trend.
Well, personally, I don't feel, threatened. I live in a community in Brighton, which, like the Pittsburgh community, many of the most of the Jews in Rochester live in that area. I don't feel threatened for myself, but I feel threatened for my race. I really feel threatened for the Jewish community of the United States, because there are so many places in this country where Jews are not welcome. Not legally, because that's against the law, but practically, socially. When you see a politician in Missouri whose campaign is, we want to get all the Jews out of the United States, it's reminiscent of Hitler's to make Germany Judenrein. What I feel probably worse about is what that effect is going to have on my children and my grandchildren. What is this country going to be like when they grow up?
Werner?
Well, I'm not worried about personal safety where I live. But I worry more about places I go to. I've been invited to speak at a very large synagogue in New Jersey, where one of my cousins is going to organize a Kristallnacht remembrance ceremony in a very large synagogue. He told me there will be 500 people there. And the first question I asked him, what about security? Now, this would have never occurred to me even a year ago. But after the Pittsburgh thing, that was one of the first thoughts. I'm going someplace where I'm not familiar with anything. And What about security?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that level of hatred, and I think about the lessons we've learned even in recent months as we talk about hate, racial division, the effort to at least meet people where they are if they grow up without exposure or understanding or poor learning. It's one thing to grow up without a good educational basis of understanding the world or even exposure to people who are different than us. And I'm not at this point just talking about people of a Jewish background. I'm talking about just the way that anybody can grow up and not understand or not have contact to. What I don't understand, Werner, is in 2018, the concern that we might still kill one another, people that we don't know and have never met, just for who they are. And that is what scares me. 80 years after everything that you experienced, I don't understand how the world 80 years later hasn't learned enough of a lesson with that. That's what scares me, and I wonder how you feel about that.
It's scary. What is going to happen at the southern border when the column gets there? Is the army waiting there with machine guns? They're going to be armed and ready to shoot. Nothing would surprise me, and that's really scary.
Warren?
Well, one of the things that bothers me is what has happened on our social media. That there are places in our social media where people can converse and exchange ideas just like the Nazi in the 20s when they were organizing the National Socialist Party. I mean, you can get on Twitter or Facebook or any of those, and you can get into media, and you can hear the same vitriolic language that you heard from Goebbels on his broadcasts. And it's that part of the social media that people can converse and exchange ideas and then carry out. That's the part that really scares me.
Yeah, Warren, you're actually making a really, I think, important but difficult point. I mean, there are literally Goebbels fan clubs still in 2018 that operate in these social media spaces. But, you know, whether it's Jack Dorsey from Twitter or others, they might say, well, should we ban that speech? And is that the can we drum that out in some way? Does it go elsewhere if we ban it? What do we do?
We don't want to ban free speech. On the other hand, there needs to be some oversight into these because the people who have, like the ones who have committed the two crimes most recently, the one, especially the one in Pittsburgh and the one in Florida who's station wagon was just plastered with Trump and hatred stuff. There needs to be a closer watch. The Southern Poverty does a wonderful job, but
Southern Poverty Law Center, yeah.
Yeah, but they're limited. I don't want to ban free speech, but I want to know who's doing it,
yeah.
They can't. You can try to stop these crimes. Unfortunately, a single person who is bent on doing the destruction, like in Pittsburgh, it's very difficult to stop. But somehow, this has to end.
Hmm. Well, 8 days from now marks 80 years since Kristallnacht, and I want to ask our guests for their recollections. I mean, it is remarkable. And Bonnie, I'll ask you first here. It is still remarkable and so important for us to hear the voices directly of people who experienced this. And that's one of the things that Temple Beth Kodesh is doing for the community and the Federation is doing here.
Yes, it's a Jewish Federation program at Temple Beth Kodesh. We feel, especially at the Center for Holocaust Awareness and Information, which is part of the Jewish Federation, that though we are looking at ways to educate when the survivors can no longer speak, right now, to me, there is nothing more meaningful than hearing a survivor speak. And when we bring survivors to schools, it does change lives and minds. You had brought up before about, well, people who have never been exposed to different kinds of people, that I find interestingly when I bring a survivor either to inner city schools or to rural schools, it's a very powerful connection that gets made. For people in the rural schools who've never met somebody different, they learn, wow, these different people are, they're like me in a lot of ways. And in the inner city where there's so much poverty and crime, that when they meet a survivor who has gone through this same kind of thing and managed to grow up to be a very productive adult, it also makes a difference in changing lives. So really hearing from a survivor, there's no substitute.
Well, 80 years ago, marking 80 years since Kristallnacht, Werner Schenk, as a Holocaust survivor, was about 6 years old.
6.5 years old.
Yeah.
It was November 9th, 1938. It was late afternoon. My parents and I were sitting in our apartment in my hometown, Lübeck. It's in northern Germany, close to Denmark, Netherlands, Sweden. It had been relatively peaceful, and there was this enormous noise, a big crash. And my father said, "That's strange." And then we heard people screaming in the street. So we went down into the street and started walking towards where the crowd was. And then we found out what the crash was all about. There was a one block up from where we lived, there was a music store. They sold anything from piccolos to grand pianos. And it was two floors high, and the upper floor was a show window. So when you walked by, you could see these beautiful instruments and pianos. And there were people in brown shirts throwing out instruments, and the crash we heard was a grand piano, which they had shoved right through the big show window into the street. That was the big noise. As we were walking there, the synagogue was very close to our house, and we saw smoke coming from there. But my mother said, we must first check out Uncle Herman. Uncle Herman was my grandfather's brother, and he owned the largest men's clothing store in town. And there was about a 10-minute walk for us to go to get there. And when we got there, it was just awful. All the show windows had been broken. There were people rummaging through the store. They were throwing the mannequins into the street and setting fire to things. We found out that my uncle was okay. He was in his apartment, and he told us, he said, "Leave, we'll rebuild, don't worry about it, they'll get over it, but check out the synagogue." So we went back towards the synagogue, and they had not sent fire to the building, but they trashed the inside. They threw everything out and made a bonfire. They had all the prayer books, the Torah scrolls were out in a big heap, and they had set it on fire. So the building wasn't burned. It was just totally gutted. And believe it or not, the SS brigade used it for their horse stable after that. More insult to that. So that's my remembrance. And again, as I said earlier, I kept saying to my parents, I was 6.5. Why is this happening? Why is this happening?
So apart from that confusion, not understanding of why it was happening, what were the primary emotions you remember as a 6.5-year-old? Was it fear? Was it mostly confusion? Was it...
I felt safe with my parents. Mm-hmm. The worst was yet to come. Yeah, after that. I learned how to be afraid much later, after that. But there's an irony to Uncle Herman. They did rebuild the store. I mean, it was only glass. And then, of course, they took the store away from him and gave it to a Nazi supporter. He took the store away. He was allowed to stay in his apartment, And he and his wife, my hometown was bombed by the British Royal Air Force in March of 1942. And the building was hit, and they were in a bomb-proof shelter in the basement. But the rubble closed off all the air passages, so they died.
Oh, boy.
In their building. So, irony.
Warren, what do you remember about Kristallnacht?
Well, personally, mostly what I remember is what you described at the beginning of the program, was that my grandfather, who was the owner of the factory where my father was the superintendent, had been arrested that night early. As you know, the Nazis made a list of about 25,000 to 30,000 Jewish men who were going to get arrested. The Goebbels and Himmler were just waiting for the smoking gun, and the smoking gun happened 3 days before when a Jew shot somebody in a third minister in Paris, and Goebbels just screamed, what are they doing to our people? Aren't you going to do something about it? And which is what fomented the Kristallnacht. So they had arrested my grandfather as part of that, and my father was told about it, and so he decided he was going to leave our house for that night and go over to sleep in the house of his father-in-law. And so 5 o'clock that morning, there was a knock on the door. My mother went down. My brother and I looked down from the second floor, and she opened the door, and there were two Gestapo officers to arrest my father. And my mother said, "But he's not here." After they looked around, they left, saying to my mother, "He better show up, otherwise it's not going to be good for you." And so my brother, who was 2 years older than I, was dressed by my mother and sent over to my where my father was staying to tell him that that the Gestapo had come to get him. But my father, because his father-in-law had already been arrested, decided he needed to go to the factory to operate it. And as he walked in, the two Gestapo were there waiting for him and took him to the police station. Stuttgart is where we lived, is in the southwestern part of Germany, way, way down. It borders on Switzerland and on France. And the anti-Semitism there was not as vile as it was up in Berlin, Hanover, or over in Munich. And so something very strange happened, which I don't think would have happened anywhere in northern Germany or in any of these other hot Nazi spots, was when my father was arrested at the police station and he knew he was going to be sent away, he asked whether he could contact my mother and if she could come down and say goodbye. And they let her do that. As I say, that probably would not have happened any other place. But we were fortunate where we lived. We lived in the suburbs of Stuttgart, a very lovely, lovely area. And also, our house, we did not own our house. It was owned by a non-Jewish person. And one of the edicts that had gone out of her Kristallnacht was destroy everything that is Jewish, but do not harm anything that is not Jewish. If you are found to loot any stores that are not Jewish or damage any non-Jewish, you will be heavily prosecuted. And so we were fortunate that our house was not invaded because we had many, many lovely things that I'm sure they would have loved to throw out. With my father gone, my mother kept the house, telling us that my father was traveling because my father was also selling for the factory. And so we were just kept pretty much in our neighborhood during the whole time until my father got out of the camp, which was a month later, and before we were finally able to leave. But that was my recollections of that night and of getting ready to move so we could get out of Germany.
Mm. Werner, I want to turn back to a point you were making about how you felt as a six-and-a-half-year-old on the night of Kristallnacht, how you were confused, but it wasn't the fear that was still to come. To obviously, no one could perhaps fully foresee what was coming. But I want to ask you if you think your parents and adults at the time had at least some of an inkling about that. As a 6.5-year-old, I hope not, though the history of Jewish persecution and the torment of Jewish people certainly wasn't new in 1938. Do you think your parents, do you think the other adults, do you think others around you felt like it was a powder keg and Kristallnacht was sort of a harbinger of some really dangerous and terrible things?
The number of Jews in Lübeck when Hitler came to power was about 500. It's a small town. There were about 500 Jews. The statistic I read recently said that when the war ended in 1945, there were 11 left. Now, I know my parents and I survived, and I have no idea who the others were. One thing that did happen, that many of the businesses that were destroyed in Kristallnacht were not reopened, and there was mass immigration. It was still possible to get out of Germany. So most of the business owners that we knew who were Jewish left. Shanghai, Turkey, Israel, United States, South America. So also, there was not much of a Gestapo presence in 1938. That started about 2 years later. That's when really things started to happen, and that's when we started to be afraid, really.
And you mentioned earlier this hour that as you read the news of what happened in Pittsburgh last weekend, you felt chills. You felt some of that same fear and confusion about that level of hatred. I just want to ask you, generally speaking, Werner, how you feel as a Holocaust survivor about the somewhat routine invocation of Hitler, of the Holocaust, of that level of hatred, and whether you think we should reserve that for truly unique and exceptionally dangerous or concerning situations, or if you think there's at least a value in understanding history that says, before the Holocaust, there was Kristallnacht. Before Kristallnacht, there was propaganda and hatred, and that incrementally we build towards those things, and it's important to recognize those in process before you get to a catastrophe. It's very sensitive for a lot of folks. I wonder how you feel about that.
I'm not sure I can know how to answer that, really. We listened to all of... There was, by the way, only one radio station you could listen to. Mm-hmm. They hardwired the connection, so your radio was only tuned in to one station, which my father actually circumvented. But regardless, so it was constantly hate speech and hate speech. But, we felt it was just talk. We looked at Hitler and Goebbels almost like caricatures. we did almost didn't take them seriously, right? Because none of our family had been really hurt. My grandparents, who lived in Lübeck, had moved to Berlin, and that's where most of my other relatives lived, aunts and uncles, etc. And they seemed to be okay, even though there were all the restrictions that were put on them. They couldn't shop in every store anymore. And I didn't start really getting a bad feeling as of when I was prevented to go to school, when the Gestapo started to make its presence felt in my hometown.
Are you worried that anything like that could ever happen in this world again?
I'm afraid yes. I'm afraid yes. We did quite a bit of talking about things like that recently when Jiva Theater put on The Diary of Anne Frank. Mm. And I was able to talk to a lot of people. And Anne Frank famously said that she thought no matter what happens, basically people are good. But I've seen some really evil people. And what makes them evil? I said that, in fact, in one of my talkbacks when the students were asking, was the Gestapo evil? Oh, yeah, they were evil. And what about the people that worked in the concentration camps, physically involved in murdering people every day? You can always find people like that. And so I'm afraid my answer is I think it could happen again.
And what do you see as the remedy for that kind of hatred, or maybe even just the seeds of that hatred that might send someone down that road? What remedies do you see, Warner?
We have to keep talking about what happened and hope that people will understand that it doesn't really have to happen, you know, that there are remedies, that there are lots of good people, honest people of all faiths. And so we have to try to prevent it. But I'm not really sure that I could say, well, this will never happen again. I mean, there have been pogroms for centuries, really, if you think about it. People hating other people. Yeah. So I'm not sure if I can really give you a good answer to that, Evan.
Warren, do you have ideas on what might be a remedy to this level of hatred?
Well, you know, I'm a couple of things. First of all, Santayana's a warning, you know, he who forgets history is doomed to live it again. I hope that is not correct. But what I'm when I see what's going on, I'm reminded of that those lyrics from South Pacific, which it's, the song's called Carefully Taught. It's part of the lyrics is you've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you're six or seven or eight. That's what I'm afraid of, is that the teaching of that, so that it goes on and on, just like in the Near East, where the Palestinian children are taught to hate the Jews, and that then they grow up with that hatred. That has to stop. The other thing is that we have to stop being silent. As Elie Wiesel said, when you see something wrong, you cannot stand by idly, because those who are silent help the perpetrators commit their crime. And we saw that in Europe when Hitler was building up his power. All of the allies were silent, Britain, France, United States. What happened after Kristallnacht just goes to show Britain didn't do anything. In fact, Britain, Chamberlain, just 2 weeks before, gave Hitler everything he wanted. France didn't do anything. The only thing the U.S. did was they recalled their ambassador. The world didn't care what happened to the Jews. And unless we speak out, that's what may happen again. And so the real bottom line is education, education, education. We have to drum it into our children as they grow up and in adults that hate is not a word that should be in our vocabulary.
Warren brings up the question of what being a real ally means. You know, if you look at what happened following Kristallnacht, you know, Warren is referencing the lack of real, viable, strong response from around the world. And just this morning, Warren, I was at parent-teacher conferences for my six-year-old. You brought up 6, 7, 8 years old. So parent-teacher conferences for my six-year-old. He came with us, so he's sitting in the room, but, you know, teachers doesn't want, and his parents don't want to hear what we're talking about him. So he grabbed an audio book, and he was sitting in the corner. And after we were walking out, we said, "So what were you reading?" And he said, "I was reading the story of how black people used to have to sit on the back of the bus." And I said, "Oh, the Rosa Parks story." And he is very confused. I mean, like, we talk a lot about race. We talk a lot about these issues. But, you know, he's six, so he's learning the story. But he's confused about why the world ever would be like that. You know, at six, to him, that doesn't make sense. But you know what he asked me this morning? He said, "Well, what did the other white people say?" And I said, "That's actually a very interesting question. And I don't fully know, even offhand myself, without going back to read, if there are any real allies right there on the bus or right in that moment or sometimes in a diner, sometimes in public settings when there was separate but ostensibly separate but equal." I mean, it was obviously a joke. So that question of what it means to be an ally, what should have happened after Kristallnacht?
Well, first of all, I think the question was it too late? Was it too late? The world was in a depression, and United States itself was an isolationist state. We know that from the immigration laws in 1924. When Britain, which was at that time probably the strongest country in maybe not as strong as U.S. but very strong. When they have their prime minister bow down, basically, to Hitler, I don't think there was any more hope. I don't think there was any more hope. And the inevitable was going to happen. Whether it was going to happen to the extent that they finally, the final decision at the Wannsee Conference was going to happen, that was not a foregone conclusion. But there was, I don't think the world, or I don't think people at that time were going to, or were afraid that there was going to be a war. For example, I think Britain was already ready for that they were going to have a war. When we came to this country in March of 1939 on a ship, that was leaving, we went from Rotterdam to Southampton to the U.S. The front of the ship could not walk on the front of the ship. When we got to the U.S., we found out why. Britain was sending its gold to the United States because it was afraid of German invasion. I'm afraid that it was too late, but the diabolical of Hitler, not necessarily Hitler, he just but Goebbels and Himmler, and especially those two, and also Heydrich, who was the deputy Führer, to go after the Jews, that was not necessarily the concentration camps and the violence. It was just thoughts of an evil minds. But I'm afraid that there was nothing anymore at that point. It had to be done in the early 30s, and it wasn't.
Mm. Werner?
A couple points, if I can go back to your point of other evil people. I came to this country not until 1950, and soon thereafter, I was actually drafted into the American Army, so I'm a veteran. And I was sent to training in Kentucky, Camp Breckinridge, Kentucky, 101st Airborne Division. And there was a little town, and whenever we could get off base, we'd go to a little town. And there were signs in most of the windows of the restaurants, no N-word and soldiers allowed. And the fountains in the station, white only, black only. And I shook my head. I said, this can't be true. So that was not that long ago, right? So that was sort of a nasty surprise to me coming to this country. So those people who supported that, they were evil, right? And some of that is still going on, obviously. The other point was, what can we do better? I never talked about any of the horrible things that happened to my family, you know, all the people that we lost. Never. The only one in my household of a beautiful wife and three kids who knew was my wife. She knew a lot of what had happened. My kids never found out. My son went to one of the Anne Frank talkbacks, and afterwards we went to eat, and he said, Dad, I found out things today that you never talked about. But that was really, that gave me the signal that says, I have to go out and talk about this. We have to tell people of what happened. And I think a lot of people will be affected by that. And I've got to thank Bonnie for dragging my butt out of the shadows, so to speak. I can use that word, I think.
You can. It's okay.
And to get out into the schools, and I'll continue doing that as long as I can.
Well, let me, before I take Ingrid's phone call, Ingrid in Penfield, hang there for 1 second. We're going to come to you in a moment. Werner Schenk, a Holocaust survivor, just brought up Bonnie Abrams, director of the Center for Holocaust Awareness and Information at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester, for dragging his tail out around public. So there's an important event that's 1 week from tonight, 7 to 8 p.m. at Temple Brith Kodesh. What's the event, Bonnie?
It is Remember and Be the Light, 80 years after Kristallnacht.
And that is open to the public?
Yes, it's open and free, open to the public and free.
Okay, and a great opportunity for once again the community to come together, similarly to how we have seen it happen, whether it was last weekend or in other times recently. So that is 1 week from tonight, 7 to 8 p.m. Warren and Warner will be there, Bonnie, yes?
Yes, they will be telling their stories.
And you can hear just this hour how vital it is that we understand these stories. I understand Warner's reticence over the years to talk about it, but I also understand now his feeling that it's almost an obligation. So Ingrid in Penfield, next on the phone. Let's get Ingrid. Go ahead.
I hope I can do this. I want to thank your guests for being there, and thank you for this program, and I think it's exactly right. The more we hear from people like you, the more we'll be able to educate. It is exactly the kind of education that's going to work the best. I also wanted to say that the reactions, when Evan asked about what should have happened after Kristallnacht, it was too late, but anyway, there's no real should. Some people are going to be more courageous than others. Those people, please do your part, step up. not everyone is capable of fighting back against something like that. There was a big element of disbelief. I see that in action this week. There was a swastika, just handwritten, no big, huge deal, handwritten on a piece of paper in an elevator at the student dormitory at the Easton School of Music. I posted about this after talking to the person who found it. I posted about this on our alumni page, and the reactions ran the gamut from taking it very seriously to someone who said, you shouldn't be giving attention to this person. I understand that, but I think we must err on the side of caution and take it very seriously. The last thing I want to say is, I believe this is not the time to be comparing how we mourn murder. I'm not going to call it a tragedy. It was murder. Many black Americans have been murdered. Jewish Americans have now been murdered. Let us not say we should have mourned better the black Americans who were murdered. I believe that that is a ploy, or it could function as a way of dividing and conquering us. Let us please not do that and just mourn all together. Thanks. That's all I wanted to say.
Ingrid, thank you for the phone call. And on the note that Ingrid raised about some people maybe not in position to push back, or some might be feeling more emboldened than others to speak out at times, I want to add a comment that we have from another listener, and then I'll ask our guests to respond to both what Ingrid said on the phone and what Evelina writes to the program. Evelina writes, Denmark was the only German-occupied country where the local authorities did not cooperate with the German orders, and less than 1% of the Jewish population there was destroyed. Real power to prevent this and to stop the spread of it is with the lowest level of authority. Parents, teachers, individual police officers, etc. Nothing big can happen without the single individual people's behaviors. Resistance is what it takes. That's from Evelina. And so combined with what Ingrid had to say, I wonder, Warner, how you feel about that. Whether it's looking back before the Holocaust, before Kristallnacht, or today in any context we want to set it, hateful violence cannot happen just with a top-down order if it is refused by individuals, is some of what Evelina is saying. What do you think?
There were a lot of individuals who resisted, and we wouldn't have survived without that. The people that absolutely were responsible for my survival and my parents' survival were Catholic nuns who stepped in and made sure that we could not be reached by the Gestapo. A good friend of my mother's, who was actually a policeman, a regular policeman, Joseph, also a Catholic, was able to warn us when it was dangerous to be around because Himmler would be in town. And a parade would happen, and the Gestapo would, they would see you, they would round you up. So you have to have that kind of resistance from the bottom up, I think. So I agree with that comment, yes.
Okay. Warren?
Yes. It has to come from the ground on up, because from the upper... it's only words. It's from the bottom. It's the action. And it has to come from mostly from the teachers. And parents have to get involved with that, too. It's gonna be a tough road because we see more nationalism, quote, nationalism, spread not only in this country, but throughout the world. And you see the seeds of what happened in the 30s. You see the seeds there. They just aren't going to be allowed to germinate, because if they do, it's just going to be maybe not the Holocaust, hopefully not, because that was a country trying to eliminate throughout the world an entire people. But we see these flaring up in other countries. Hopefully we will learn from this and point out the bigots, advertise them, shame them, and maybe that's the way to do it.
Warren and Werner, Holocaust survivors, I want to thank them for being here. Warren Heilbrunner, it's nice to see you again, and thank you for being here to share your stories and your perspective.
It's been a pleasure to be here under these circumstances. The remembering the Holocaust is not very, and what happened from it. Just one little note, when I speak to kids in school, I often say to them, why is it just because I maybe talk to God differently than you, why is it that you hate me because I'm different?
Yeah, an important question. Thank you, Warren. Warner Schenck, I still appreciate your perspective. And again, I know it's not easy, but we're all better for hearing it. Thank you.
Evan, it's been my privilege. Thank you for doing this.
And Bonnie Abrams from the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester, thank you for what you're doing. 1 week from tonight at Temple Beth Kodesh, 7 to 8 p.m., remember and be the light. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.